thanks for coming along tonight. Thanks to the people who are good audience here tonight, and also to those who are on Zoom and will watch this in other ways. So tonight we have Dr. Zachary Gorman here to talk about his most recent publication in the very impressive Australian Biographical Monograph series, which Connor Court in Brisbane, in Queensland, puts out. And his topic tonight is Joseph Cook, which, as you know, I guess is why you're here, was Australia's third Prime Minister. Now, Dr. Gorman is a professional historian. He's done a book on Sir Joseph Carruthers, the Liberal leader in years gone by, decades gone by in New South Wales. He's done a book on Magna Carta. He has done an edited collection on Captain Cook. He's also done this edited collection, The Young Menzies, Success, Failure and Resilience, 1894 to 1942, which contains chapters by the likes of David Kemp, Troy Bramson, James Edelman, the High Court judge, Judith Brett, Anne Henderson and Scott Prasser and others. So we've got a few copies of that. But tonight we're doing the Melbourne launch of Zachary Gorman. Zachary, sorry. Who wrote that? But tonight we're doing the Sydney launch. The Melbourne launch haven't been done by David Kemp. We're doing the Sydney launch of Zachary Gorman's Joseph Cook. And the title is Joseph Cook, the first centre-right leader to win a majority government at a federal election. Many thanks.
Yeah, so today marks the 110th anniversary of the first time a centre-right party won a majority government at an Australian federal election, and they did it under a largely forgotten Liberal leader named Sir Joseph Cook, who subsequently became Australia's sixth Prime Minister. But I've always thought, despite the fact that Cook didn't stay in office very long, he only had 450 days as Prime Minister, I've always thought that this is a landmark moment in Australia's political history, because it's the moment that sort of proves that a centre-right liberalism facing off against Labor is the natural fault line of Australian politics. It had already emerged before the Great War, even though the Great War disturbed that fault line and it ultimately got subsumed into the Nationalists and then the UAP, but then it re-emerges under Robert Menzies. But I think it's really important to sort of look at these early figures and understand why Australian liberalism ends up on the centre-right. And a big reason why Australian liberalism ends up on the centre-right is that liberals had essentially triumphed so much in the 19th century that to preserve what existed to be a conservative by the early 20th century was to be a liberal, was to try to defend that liberal order. Cook's life story is a remarkable immigrant's tale of Australian social mobility, and that sort of sense of the boundless opportunities available to those willing to work hard in Australia shaped his liberal worldview, which I maintain is highly relevant today. Above all, Cook had this profound belief in the power of human agency, the ability of a studious and moral individual to improve their lot in life and to improve the world around them. That was his personal creed throughout his entire life. And as you will hear, he came from very rough circumstances that actually lived up to that sort of ideology that you could do whatever you wanted if you put in the hard yards. So there had certainly been centre-right governments in Australian federal politics before that of Cook, namely those of Edmund Barton, George Reid, and more debatably, Alfred Deakin, who relied explicitly on Labor support until the fusion of the fiscal parties in 1909, and who was therefore often sort of effectively centre-left. But all of them had been minority governments, fractious coalitions, or that initial fusion which only lasted a couple of years and was completely smashed when Deakin led it to the 1910 election. It was Cook who proved that a united Liberal Party that self-consciously sat on the centre-right of Australia's political divide could be electorally successful, and at a time when the modern Liberal Party is at a historic low point, his story and values provide important lessons for today. Normally, when the Liberal Party needs to go soul-searching, it turns to Robert Menzies, and I'm not in a great position to disparage that instinct because I work for an organisation called the Robert Menzies Institute. But nevertheless, I think it's really important to understand that the wellspring of Australian liberalism goes far deeper than 1944, and indeed it predates political parties altogether. Cook was politically active during the era in which the Australian political divide first emerged, both in the dying days of colonial politics and the earlier stages of the federal arena, and his story charts the how and the why of the emergence of the Australian party system and the philosophical lines of cleavage which continue to shape our nation. Indeed, remarkably, not only is Cook the first Liberal to outright win a federal election, but he was also the first parliamentary leader of the New South Wales Labor Party. Cook was thus the first in a long line of what have been disparagingly dubbed Labor rats, the modern examples of which range from Warren Mundine, Mark Latham, and according to her recent maiden speech, the quite high profile nowadays Victorian MLC, Moira Deeming. Because Cook left Labor and became more conservative, or at least explicitly Burkean over the years, he has often been attacked as a model of political inconsistency. His previous biographer, John Murdoch, described him as floating as if a cork on a lifeboat after a particularly unpleasant storm. But I would contend that Cook was actually a conviction politician whose views on certain policy matters certainly evolved with the passage of time, but who always had this personal creed of the importance of freedom of conscience, self-reliance and self-improvement. And that sort of clarity of belief is something that you might say the modern Liberal Party has been lacking in recent years. And on that issue of consistency, it's also worth pointing out that there's even some debate over whether Cook was ever a member of what we now know as the Labor Party. His branch of the Labor Party was actually declared illegitimate by the central executive because they supported him in opposing the introduction of the Caucus Pledge. And in one debate with Billy Hughes, who was ironically throwing stones at Cook for his rat status before Hughes himself had ratted on the Labor Party, Cook made it clear that he felt that the original Labor Party of 1891 and the pledged entity which emerged in 1894 were entirely separate, that these were two Labor parties, essentially. But before we get to the split over the pledge, it is important to understand Cook's remarkable journey before he even entered politics. So Cook was born in the Staffordshire mining town of Silverdale in 1860 as the eldest son of poor but aspirational parents. As a child, he only owned one pair of shoes, and his dwellings were often infested with rats. He entered the mines as a pit boy at the age of 9, received very little in the way of formal schooling, and became the family's primary breadwinner at the age of 12, when his father was tragically killed in a mining accident. I think for most people, this would have been a crushing burden that would have overwhelmed, but Cook remarkably rose to the occasion and became at a very young age a responsible head of the household. And a lot of the reason he was able to do that was because he was imbued with this really strong religious conviction from his family's Methodism. He was so religious that he became a lay preacher and almost took up a whole career in preaching when he was offered a position to study at the famous New Connection College at Ranmore, but he had to decline that opportunity to continue to provide for his mother and siblings. Also stemming from Cook's Methodism was that profound belief in human agency to which I already referred. Cook never believed that the circumstances of his birth would determine his lot in life, and his family really encouraged him in that self-belief. His favourite author was the American Ralph Waldo Emerson, who wrote on these sort of empowering themes, and Cook became something of an autodidact, fitting in study wherever he could around his work in the mines. Later in life, when the journalist Malcolm Ellis asked Cook about his experiences as a miner, Cook would reply with a wry smile that it was an occupation for a philosopher. Cook's self-improvement was assisted by the fact that he married a schoolteacher and literally got the education he was lacking from not going to school, from marrying a school teacher who helped him learn arithmetic, who used to read aloud for Cook to practice his shorthand, all these sorts of things. When an economic downturn forced Cook to leave Silverdale, it was Mary's brother who encouraged them to move to Australia. And basically they took the risk because Cook had already raised one family in tremendously harsh conditions, and he was determined not to have to repeat the process. So he took the punt on Australia. Sailing out of Plymouth on Christmas Day 1885, he had to leave a pregnant Mary behind in England as he made his way to Sydney, found a mining job in Lithgow, and began building a family home with his own bare hands. And he laid a solid foundation for both he and Mary that would eventually support a family of up to 9 children. There's some debate over how many children he actually had, but 9 is the number that I sort of go with. When Cook was later High Commissioner in London during the 1920s, he used to sell Australia to potential migrants in these big advertising campaigns as the land of the better chance, and that's certainly what it proved to be for him. He supplemented his mining income by becoming an accountant. So again, Mary had been so good at teaching him maths that he was able to then become an accountant, and he kept books for the mine owners and the local council, and he became a prominent figure in Lithgow as president of his union lodge, actively campaigning on public issues such as trying to stop a mine being built under the Lithgow Water Reserve. A moderate rather than a radical, even when he was in the union movement, Cook tried to resist the Great Maritime Strike, in which coal miners stopped working as part of these sort of sympathy strikes to rob the maritime bosses of their fuel. But when the strike's failure led unionists to conclude that they would have a better chance at achieving change by getting elected to Parliament, Cook put up his hand to be a candidate for the nascent Labor Party. And at the 1891 New South Wales election, which is the first the party ever contested, he comfortably topped the poll for Lithgow's local seat of Hartley. Cook supported core Labor policies like the 8-hour day, coal mines regulation, and race-based immigration restriction, but he was also a strong supporter of free trade, which he believed provided economic opportunities and ensured that goods were as cheap as possible for poor working people. One of the free traders' main slogans at the time was to call for the so-called free breakfast table, in which basics like salt and sugar would be made more affordable for struggling families, and the same logic could be applied to manufactured goods. One time Cook would even suggest that nobody should be Minister for Trade and Customs unless they had had at least 10 children, leaving even his own fruitful loins as falling short of the prerequisite. The so-called fiscal issue of free trade versus protectionism was then the main dividing line in politics, and what were arguably New South Wales's first political parties emerged at the 1887 election, in which candidates split into camps based on their attitude towards the issue. There were conservatives and radicals on both sides of the debate, and indeed Labor itself was heavily divided over the fiscal issue, so much so that in its first term, Labor's parliamentary members repeatedly split apart, some voting for the government, some voting for the opposition. The extra-parliamentary organisation grew very frustrated at this and determined to enforce discipline ahead of the 1894 election. One of the things they did was to get the parliamentary party to finally elect a leader, because they had previously tried to rule by committee in the hope of remaining more clear equals. And Cook was elected as the first leader based on his powers as a speaker, but also because he had that sort of tremendous work ethic that had seen him memorise parliamentary procedures and also have one of the best attendance records in the parliament. So the Labor Party, the extra parliamentary organisation, that's one aspect that they try to enforce discipline by getting a leader elected. But the other thing they did is they try to institute this pledge that every member of Labor has to vote according to the majority will of caucus on any issue affecting the Labor platform or the fate of the government. And considering in that first term Labor was in office, the government of Henry Parkes had gone down over an adjournment motion, the latter part of the pledge meant basically you would have absolutely no freedom of action as a Labor Party MP. You could only ever do anything according to what caucus allowed you to do. Now, this was a real assault on the principles of the sort of liberal hierarchy, the liberal dominant political creed at the time, because they maintained that not only was freedom of conscience really crucial, but this pledge went against the whole role of an MP who had to represent their district and rule in a sort of Burkean manner where they're making up their own mind of what is in the national interest. They couldn't be beholden and controlled by an outside force like the caucus was. Judith Brett has gone so far as to argue that the pledge turned out to be the issue which shaped Australia's political divide, because it was the issue on which the left-leaning Deakin ended up on the centre-right, even though he agreed with many Labor policies. And Liberals have certainly had a lot of issues trying to square this belief in freedom of conscience with necessary party discipline over the years. But I would say that the Victorian Division's recent expulsion of a backbencher was really a betrayal of this sort of 120 years of tradition of Australian liberalism. For Cook, the pledge was a violation of everything that he stood for. As a devoutly religious man, he needed to be able to vote according to how his conscience compelled him. His whole life had involved earning a material and moral independence for himself, in which he would be able to make decisions on his own as a man. And he was also just insulted that the parliamentary party that had just elected him leader was basically being treated as a bunch of losers that didn't know what to do and had to be put into line by this external organisation. So Cook declares that he would refuse to be a slave and announces his independence from the parliamentary party in an extended manifesto, from the extra parliamentary organisation rather, in an extended manifesto that attracts the support of a majority of the parliamentary members. So that's why Cook is sort of saying the original Labor Party is this non-pledged entity, the majority of people elected under that non-pledged entity stuck by him. And then he was at the 1894 election. A lot of these people who refuse to submit to the pledge do get kicked out of Parliament. Eight of them survive, including Cook. And Cook ultimately joins George Reid's Free Traders when, as Premier, Reid offers him the ministerial position of Postmaster General, the idea being that you take the leader of those eight independent men and then you get the vote of all eight men, so you've got a lot more secure position in Parliament if you can attract that support really steadily. And Cook had already really proven himself to be a free trader through that first term as well. And he does a lot of important things as in that ministerial role, things like introducing the first payphones, pushing for telephone lines to go underground, and the introduction of the bicycle for faster letter delivery. So if the pledge, that freedom of conscience argument, that need to have a parliamentary system that's free from the control of outside forces, if this is one of the core components of Australian liberalism, which Cook embodied, what were the others? One was a belief in equality, but certainly not equality of outcomes. As a Christian, Cook believed that people were equal in the sight of God, that they needed to go out of their way to help one another, and that charity was all important. But he was equally aware that it was the need to struggle and to improve which had turned him into the man that he was. He gave speeches in Parliament where he insisted that the solution to society's ills was not legislation alone, but the improvement of human character. People needed to live up to their responsibilities like he had, or as Menzies would later put it, be lifters rather than leaders. During the anti-socialist campaign of 1905-6, Cook would argue that to average out humanity and subsume the individual into the mass would lead to the erosion of morals and eventually the reversal of all human progress. This also ties into another core liberal belief in opportunity, which in an immigrant society such as Australia is all important. From the time he became a minister, Cook was very much held up as an embodiment of the nation's social mobility. And when he was eventually knighted in 1918, the Sydney Morning Herald lauded him as a stunning example of the opportunities offered to all citizens of a free democracy. But coming back to equality as a liberal ideal, Liberals had been fighting for legal and political equality since the colony's earliest days. Things like ensuring ex-convicts had equal rights, preventing the establishment of a bunyip aristocracy, or a legally predominant Church of England were all core Liberal triumphs of the 19th century. In Cook's day, the fight was to abolish plural voting, which allowed people to vote in more than one electorate if they owned multiple properties, and instead to establish what was emotively dubbed one man, one vote. Now, this was an issue that was raised by a divisive referendum that was going on at the time, that on federation, because a Senate which gave equal representation to each state, regardless of population, seemed to undermine that one man, one vote principle or equal weighting of votes principle that had only recently won recognition. And that is why Cook, along with many other New South Welshmen, voted no at the first referendum poll in 1898. Indeed, I've done a journal article where I've shown that Sydney actually votes no on both occasions. Sydney never votes yes to federation. But Cook was also opposed to federation, at least initially he votes yes in 1899, because he had a strong belief in the Liberal concept of subsidiarity, this idea that political decisions are best made at the most local level, which is practical. And this comes from his sort of dealing with Labour Central Executive and Union Central Executive. He always got along a lot were better with people in Lithgow and in his local community. He really sort of valued that community. Cook was more consistent than some Liberals on this equal voting issue because he was also an early advocate of female suffrage, likely a reflection of his high regard for Mary's opinion on important matters. As Prime Minister, one of the main things that Cook fought for was actually the reintroduction of postal votes to ensure that everyone would have equal access to the franchise, whereas the Fisher Labor government had actually abolished postal votes because the stereotype at the time was that it was something only utilized by rich women who didn't want to deal with the riffraff at the polling booth and who were just going to vote Labor, against Labor anyway. Cook ultimately risks, as when he does become Prime Minister, Cook would ultimately risk the first double dissolution in Australian political history, and he does it in an attempt to abolish preference to unionists in government employment, which was a real undermining of equality, which, considering Labor had deliberately politicized the union movement, essentially made a man's political affiliation determine his ability to access a taxpayer-funded salary. And speaking of taxpayer money, Cook also practiced the oft-preached Liberal principle of spending as little money as possible so as to take as little money off the people as possible at a time when that relationship between spending and taxation was understood far more directly because direct taxes had only recently been introduced. Cook would practice parsimony not only as Prime Minister but also as Treasurer under Billy Hughes in the early 1920s. And even when he takes on the High Commissioner job and has this really cushy diplomatic posting, Cook then leads a major retrenchment in the bloated staff of Australia House. So he's always a stickler for a wasted dollar his whole life. And the sort of final Liberal principle that Cook espoused was a tremendous Australian patriotism. He had this sense of perspective because he had come from England and knew how bad it was. He knew how much better things were in Australia, not just in terms of opportunity and social mobility, but also statistics like rates of home ownership and wealth distribution. He gives a speech in Parliament where he defends Australian larrikins, who were very much attacked at the time. This whole Australian love of larrikin is a sort of more sort of radical nationalist 20th century development. Early on, we were always attacking larrikins in Parliament. How could we possibly have these people who are just sort of layabouts trying to have fun? And Cook argues that this is the natural rebound from the dull grey industrial grad grind existence of older countries. And he would also argue against socialism based on the idea that Australia was already so successful and prosperous that it would be the last place in the world where you would want to risk a revolution trying to further outdo all of humanity. So that's why he ends up on the centre-right, because he's just got this immense appreciation of the Liberal order that exists in Australia and how successful it is and how it's so much better than so many other places. And while he still wants progress, he doesn't want progress to ever risk the heart of that system. He wants consolidated, small step progress, a lot of which will be driven by the actions of individuals rather than the directing power of the state. So if Cook was a prototypical and influential Liberal leader, which is essentially what I've been arguing, why is he so little remembered? Well, that brings us back to the political narrative. At the first federal election in 1901, Cook was persuaded to stand for the seat of Parramatta because the free traders thought it would help them win the seat. His initial inclination was just to stick in state politics and hopefully become premier. He easily tops that poll for Parramatta, and nationally, the election produces a similar three-party system to that which had existed in New South Wales, with a protectionist government, free trade opposition, and smaller crossbench Labor Party. However, the combination of Labor winning enough seats to be essentially as big as both fiscal parties at the 1903 election, and then it, in 1905, adopting the first version of the socialist objective, which called for the nationalisation of monopolies and the extension of the industrial and economic functions of the state, led George Read to conclude that the greater threat to Australia's liberal freedoms and economic system was Labor rather than protectionist tariffs. And he subsequently embarks on his famous anti-socialist campaign, touring the nation, trying to convince people of the necessities of a two-party system in which elections will directly determine who is in government, as opposed to these continuous hung parliaments that you'd been having in the early federal period, where it was who was in government was left up to the machinations of politicians. Reid's campaign was a vast logistical exercise that meant he was away from the House of Representatives for very long periods of time, and it was only made possible by Cook, who gets elected deputy leader of the anti-socialists and serves effectively as opposition leader for a lot of this period of time because Reid's just never there. Alfred Deakin is initially sceptical of Reid's anti-socialist push, and indeed he wrecks the Reid-McLean government, which is a short-lived coalition between the fiscal parties that's what makes Reid Australia's fourth Prime Minister, albeit for an even shorter period than Cook. At the 1906 election, Reid's anti-socialist campaign sees him achieve a notable swing and receive more than 47% of the vote in the Senate, which was more than 10 points higher than any other single party had ever achieved before. So he gets reasonably close to actually achieving that two-party system he is after. But the small rump that remains of Deakin's party in the House of Representatives is able to hold on with Labor support and pass this new, really large protectionist tariff on the basis of new protection. Nevertheless, Deakin could see the writing was on the wall and that a two-party system was inevitable, and his centrist party ends up going right rather than left due to a number of issues, including the pledge, the extent of Labor's socialism, and even a dispute over how to build Australia's Navy. Reid steps aside from the leadership of the anti-socialists because he knows how much Deakin hates him, and Cook becomes leader of the anti-socialists and then deputy of the Deakin-Cook fusion ministry, also known as the Commonwealth Liberal Party. Cook becomes Minister for Defence at a time when strategic concerns were at the top of the national agenda, and he can lay claim to having founded Australia's Navy, commissioning its first flagship HMAS Australia, along with a number of other vessels. He also passes the substantial 1909 Defence Act, establishes the Royal Military College at Duntroon, and lays the earliest groundwork for an Australian Air Force by offering a £5,000 prize for the design of a military aircraft. At the 1910 election, as I already referred to, Deakin gets utterly smashed, and eventually Cook takes over as opposition leader with a little over 100 days to go until the next election. Helped by a series of Labor referendum proposals that seemed to make the threat of socialism very real and tangible, because Labor was quite literally after the constitutional powers to be able to carry out its full platform, Cook embarks on a national speaking tour where he tirelessly rails against Labor's high taxation and a cost of living crisis very similar to that which we are experiencing today. As an alternative, he puts forward a positive vision to, quote, develop the vast resources of our wonderful continent, making it the home of millions of free, enlightened and prosperous people, which is basically an electoral program that involves very high levels of immigration under the impetus of populate or perish, but immigration that would then be counterbalanced by deliberate attempts at decentralization and developing country areas so you wouldn't just get everyone in the cities, as it turned out people would. And on the back of this, on this day in 1913, Cook picks up 7 seats, which is admittedly only enough for a 1-seat majority, considering Deakin had somehow managed to lose 16 seats in 1910 in a House of Representatives that's roughly half the size of the House of Representatives we have today. But Cook's was nevertheless a landmark achievement. It was not enough to take control of the Senate, which was then not elected on proportional representation, meaning that the party that got the largest segment of the vote in a given state tended to take all of its seats. Faced with an obstructionist upper house, Cook decided to risk a double dissolution because the quote is that he was a man who feels deeply and scorns the art of the time service. So Cook wasn't happy being in office, achieving nothing, getting no legislation through the upper house. He thought, even if it means that I might get thrown out, I will at least risk the double dissolution to actually be able to accomplish something. But this plan gets thrown out when the election campaign is interrupted by the outbreak of the First World War, and Cook has to cut short his political campaigning to focus on war matters. Certain things happen as far as the early war, while he's prime minister. For example, we seize all the German islands in the Pacific, and he's got to focus on these sort of strategic planning matters. He's not able to campaign, whereas Labour is able to keep up its campaigning because it has a light load as opposition, and it also has this sort of strong union membership to fall back on. And at a time when there was no radio or television to be able to broadcast your views, and the state still had very sort of insulated and separate political cultures because they had been independent colonies so recently, without that in-person campaigning, Cook never really stood a chance. What the result of the 1914 election would have been without the outbreak of conflict, we will never know. But as I said, I think it's really notable that the natural fault lines of Australian politics, being centre-right liberalism, facing off against Labour, had already clearly emerged, only to be obscured by the circumstances of the war. Cook would have 3 sons enlist in the AAF, one of whom, Sid, landed at Gallipoli on Anzac Day and was shot through the face, but miraculously survived. Utterly convinced that the war was necessary for Australia's survival, Cook came to reluctantly support conscription as opposition leader, but his hesitation and delay in doing this, compared to other sort of centre-right figures who just were hell for leather for conscription from the get-go, the fact that Cook took his time making up his mind played a crucial role in how everything played out, because it didn't immediately become a party issue as it otherwise would have, and instead Billy Hughes was able to have some time in office to be able to make up his own mind on the issue. And when Hughes's decision tears the Labour Party asunder once again, Cook decides to keep him in office rather than force an election, because he wants Australia to have this sense of national unity and stability to focus on the war. And that's the same reason he ultimately sacrifices the original Liberal Party, which is absorbed into the nationalists around the circumstances of the 1917 election. Cook would go on to do other important things. He was de facto Deputy Prime Minister from 1917 to 1921, and he serves as Billy Hughes's treasurer, as I mentioned. He's one of the official signatories, just 2 Australian official signatories of the Treaty of Versailles, and he even personally helps to draw up the borders of Czechoslovakia in a generous manner that would help to precipitate Hitler's later calls for annexation. So he ends up being the British representative on the panel drawing up Czechoslovakia's borders, and obviously he hasn't been in Europe for decades at this point, apart from coming to England late in the war, but he still gets to make that decision. From 1921 to 1927, Cook not only served as Australia's High Commissioner in London, going to great lengths to secure finances for the schemes of the Bruce Page government and raising Australia's first loan of US dollars, but he's also Australia's chief representative at the League of Nations in Geneva. And on the back of this, he becomes involved in a controversy surrounding Italy's invasion of Abyssinia in the mid-1930s. Passing away in 1947, at a time when a Federal Liberal Party had re-emerged but had yet to find success, Cook has tended to be forgotten because his time in office was so short, but nevertheless, I would argue that his impact on Australian politics, and particularly the evolution of the Australian centre-right, are far greater than his 450 days as Prime Minister would make it appear. Well, obviously, like any politician from a century ago, there are aspects of his career that have dated very poorly. He was a strong supporter of White Australia, as were the vast majority of politicians across all parties at the time. Otherwise, he's very much an embodiment of what the centre-right needs to be if it is to be successful, this sort of beacon of hope for people in very difficult circumstances but with grand ambitions. An example for migrants who come to this country because they like how it is and hope to share in its bountiful fruits. And fundamentally, a clear example that hard work and dedication will take you far in Australia. Thank you.
Many thanks, Zach Gorman. Now, when introducing our speaker, I should have said, I know you've picked it up, that Zach is the academic coordinator of the Robert Menzies Institute at the University of Melbourne, but he's here tonight on the occasion of the Sydney launch of Joseph Cook. Now, we're going to question discussion, finish no doubt in the top of the hour, but you start your book off, Joseph Cook is one of Australia's least remembered prime ministers, which is true, but you're changing that. But I guess what he's a man from central England. How did he get on with his colleagues, that guy from Wales, Billy Hughes? They both went to Versailles together. Hughes is alleged to have told Paderewski to take his plan back to Poland and play it on his piano. How did Joseph Cook behave at there?
Well, it's really ironic that Cook ends up sacrificing the original Liberal Party to save Billy Hughes as Prime Minister, because there was no other person in all of politics who he had disagreed with more through his entire political career. There's pages in Hansard where Billy Hughes is comparing Cook to the serpent, to Satan himself, is the line. And after a couple more references to Satan, he gets rebuked by the speaker to stop referring to Satan. And Cook, in turn, apparently his nickname for Billy Hughes was That Little Devil. And they got along so poorly when they were both in England together in 1918 and at Versailles, that it actually got brought up in the House of Representatives as a question for the ministry, that it was affecting the national interest that these two men hated each other so much. But at the same time, Cook always had this ability to be loyal and to deputise himself. He had managed to get along with Deakin, who he equally had really clashed with. So he knew where to sort of hold his tongue and what principles he would have to sacrifice. And at the end of the day, to him, the war was greater than anything that was contemporary, that the war was greater than the need to keep the Liberal Party alive. It was greater than the need to be angry at Billy Hughes. The war was everything to him.
So, right down the back. Okay.
How did Cook get on with Percy Dean, Billy's private secretary, who was the subject of Billy and Percy, which was the telemovie put out by ABC? Maybe you didn't cover that, but Percy Dean.
Sorry, it's not something that has come up in my research. One of the issues we have with Cook, both Cook and George Reid, they completely lack their own sort of personal papers. So the extent to which you can really dive deep into them, it is to some extent limited. My book does tend to focus on the sort of public, personal persona of Cook. But at the same time, there are real consistencies about his style and things that he's doing as a Labor man that he's still doing as a Liberal. And a lot of that is around that ideology of self-improvement and that sort of being a politician that was still semi a preacher. So those are the things that I've really like picked out that are unique about him. But we do have a limited access to what he was really like because of that lack of personal papers.
On the topic of conscription, do you see any parallel between the way that Cook was very unwilling to get on board with conscription in contrast with the way that the coalition used conscription to send conscripts to Vietnam, which I think actually to some large extent destroyed their intellectual and moral credibility.
Yeah, I think you could make that argument. One of the things I know about the decision to introduce conscription in the 1960s, there's two aspects of it that are worth mentioning. One is that the initial decision to introduce conscription was made before we committed troops to Vietnam, and it was actually the focus was on that we were very likely to have a war with Indonesia. That was the real concern at the time. And two, conscription was almost a byproduct of the Menzies government's economic success, because under the Menzies government, you had full employment. So it was one of the hardest times possible to actually raise an army, because so few people were willing to enlist because there was so much ample work available. The actual numbers you needed were certainly not the numbers you needed for the AIF in World War I, but because there was so much ample employment, it was just really difficult at that time to get people to voluntarily enlist.
Thank you, Zach, for that fascinating talk. The Labour Party's victory in the 1914 election, I believe, was its greatest victory in its history, with the possible exception of 1943. Therefore, it seems to me that you're tracing that victory, or the Liberals' defeat, to the outbreak of war and Cook being sort of busy, is a little bit insufficient. I wonder if there are other factors which were at play.
I would say that, well, definitely the 1910 election defeat under Deakin was far more significant, both in terms of seats lost and in terms of the actual overall votes. There are certain seats that are actually quite close in the 1914 election that makes the seat numbers look worse than the actual election result was. I will admit that there are extenuating circumstances around whether he would have actually won the double dissolution. And you would think that being an incumbent in wartime would be very powerful for a government. But perhaps there was that uncertainty because it had been a one-seat majority, and because he had had no control over the Senate, that voting for the incumbent wasn't necessarily voting for stability in that sense.
Question on the back? Yeah.
You mentioned that he was like quite pro-suffrage, and that was partially because of his relationship with his wife and his admiration for his wife. Are you able to speak a little bit more about his involvement in suffrage or any other women-related law or policy making, if there is anything more?
Yeah, it's more of a, like, because it was an issue being debated in Australian politics in the 1890s, particularly South Australia was, I think, the first place in the world to grant women the vote, and that happens in 1890s. It was just something that cropped up during election campaigns a lot. What is your opinion on this particular point? And Cook was always clear that he was pro-female suffrage. I don't know of any extent to which he was sort of actively campaigning in a broader sense.
Thank you. You've covered the 1913 and 1914 election, good, but 1910, can you? Why the huge swing to Labor there, winning both the House of Representatives and the Senate there, 1 year after the fusion?
Well, I think the circumstances of the fusion really upset everybody, because people of the sort of centre-left who had been Deaconites didn't trust the free traders, and the free traders who had been spending who'd been spending a decade talking about how awful Deakin was, it was very hard to convince people to vote for Deakin in those circumstances. There's no compulsory voting, so if you have no motivation, you really don't like the guy, you don't even have to physically vote for Labor. You can just not vote at all, and that vote will essentially go to Labor because there won't be that counterbalance. So, yeah, there was inevitably going to be sort of trade-offs to the fusion. And I admittedly, Deakin cops the brunt of that. But Deakin had also never been a electorally successful leader. He leads a political party to elections in 1903, 1906, and 1910, and loses a large number of seats at each of those elections. Deakin's very much, I think a good comparison can be made with a Julia Gillard, in that what he really was skilled at was working a hung parliament, dealing with people to be able to get legislation through in difficult circumstances. That was Deakin's real skill, but his skill was not as a political campaigner. He didn't go on the grand national tours to the extent that Reid and Cook did, putting in that hard yards to really make real a national community when the national community was only essentially a piece of paper signed in 1901.
Robert Menzies' announcement in 1939 that Britain was at war, therefore Australia was at war, is well known. What did Cook do when he was announcing Australia's commitment in 1914?
Well, I know that he just sort of immediately committed 20,000 troops, which is what Canada and New Zealand were offering. So it was very much just an instinctual. It wasn't even, I don't think there was even the same level of announcement that Robert Menzies had, because even by 39, you're sort of after the Statute of Westminster, there still is a certain separation. In 1914, it was so taken as a given that Australia would be at war when Britain was at war, that there barely was a sort of announcement in that sense. But what I would say is that Cook is very clear in his election speeches from the 1914 election that he was never a jingoist. He was never like, we're going to win this war straight away. He was always concerned right from the get-go about the consequences. He always felt it would be a long and enduring process with very, very heavy costs, even though he ultimately determined that it was a necessary one.
Zach, we think of elections in very sophisticated and organised terms, and parties are very sophisticated and organised, but we're going back now to when things were very fledgling, very fluid. Tell us, how did a leader of a federal party communicate across this vast continent with no radio, no... Well, I suppose as the newspapers, but even then, I suppose it was difficult getting your message across. Tell us a little bit about how it was done. How did you unite people around your message?
Yeah, like you had telegrams and certain things to be able to communicate, but I think a classic example is at the 1906 election, you had an entire Western Australia party that just created their own political party because things were still that separate. The best you could do, and this is why Reid does this extraordinary effort with the anti-socialist campaign to visit every state and talk to as many people face-to-face as possible, because that's how you had to do it. You had to do it very manually, very hard, grassroots and hard. And it's impossible to think today that you would have a leader of the opposition just not show up in Parliament for months at a time. But that's literally what Reid did, because that was the way that he thought was the only way to get his message across.
Can you tell us a little bit about what Cook thought of the Treaty of Versailles, the lead up to the war itself? What were his sort of philosophical views? Did he comment on that at great length?
The main thing that Cook comes across from the Treaty of Versailles is that he was actually a huge believer in the potential of the League of Nations. He actually was a bit like sort of Everett with the United Nations in that sense. Cook always thought that the League of Nations might actually be something that could prevent future conflict. But one of the things that he really believed about the League of Nations was that the whole premise of the League of Nations initially was that you're only going to let nations into the league who you consider to be fully fledged nations and who you would be willing to go to war to defend. That the premise was that if any one of these League of Nations gets invaded, then we have to defend them. That's what's going to keep the order up. And that's why he becomes involved in this controversy surrounding the invasion of Abyssinia in the mid-1930s, is because when Abyssinia had first been admitted to the League, Cook had argued against it because he basically said, well, are we actually going to defend Abyssinia? I don't think we're going to defend Abyssinia. And that's exactly what happened. No one defended Abyssinia in 1935, and Hitler was emboldened and everything else. He saw the whole concept blow up in his face, and he even had the indignity of the member for the Mussolini government arguing in the League of Nations was citing Cook to try to justify the invasion, even though the irony was that what Cook was trying to avoid was precisely the occurrence that was happening.
So to what extent, to what extent do you have, you're speaking about Cook and Reid, you're talking about the fusion between the free traders and the protectionists, Deakin, the former, of course, of Sydney, Deakin, Melbourne. To what extent was this free trade protection issue that was that came together in 1909 with this sort of compromise, to what extent was it an interstate or intercity dispute? To what extent was it people who just had different philosophies about politics?
It was definitely the state basis was a considerable underpinning, and particularly not just state basis, but Sydney as the free trade city. That's why Sydney votes no at both referendums, because it is just that much of a sort of free trade city. And sort of ideologically, the protectionists had to justify all these sorts of contradictions, because the whole point of Australian liberalism in the 19th century is that people want to say that they're upholding the principles of William Gladstone, that we were such a part of empire that the best thing you could do is sort of live up to the hero from the old country who's fighting for your particular side of politics. But William Gladstone was a free trader, so that inherently the free traders were being more philosophically and ideologically consistent in what classical liberalism was meant to mean, whereas the protectionists had this sort of contradiction. And I definitely think that that sort of played out as far as the sort of politics of it, that when Deakin became leader, I think that some of the heaviest losses in 1910 were in New South Wales, that there was this real backlash.
So there's one question here. Can we get a microphone up here? I think it's the second last question, last one here. There we go.
Okay, so he's a liberal. What can he tell the Liberals today? What could he say? What would he say to the Liberal leader in Victoria? What would he say to who is the Liberal leader in New South Wales? Liberal leader in New South Wales, the federal leader. What is the experience of that early belief in aspirational politics, probably? The notion of, I suppose, a fluidity of trade and whatever. What can they say, Joseph Cook, to today's Liberals?
Well, I already sort of referenced that I think what Pizzuto's done in Victoria is an absolute betrayal of Australian liberalism. I'm not entirely impartial on that because I know some of the people involved.
Can I just interrupt you? Just tell us what it is. It's the expulsion of a...
Of Moira Deeming from the Victorian Parliamentary Party.
Okay.
But I think that, yeah, that there was this broader philosophy that that Reid and Cook were trying to uphold. And I think that modern liberals have sort of lost sight of the fact that they are custodians of Australia's oldest political tradition. We are the country in which liberalism triumphed in the 19th century, because none of what it meant to be a Tory conservative in Britain, as far as that established Church of England, that hereditary aristocracy, even the role of the military, all those things that were what it meant to be a Tory and a conservative in Britain at the time, none of those succeeded in Australia. So Australia was this great sort of liberal triumph to some extent. And you've got to uphold those sort of principles, not to get too into modern debates sort of over the voice. But I think it is interesting that there are certain echoes of that debate over whether you would allow Parliament to become controlled or influenced by outside forces. These are issues that Australian liberalism has been grappling with for centuries. And I think even if you're electorally unsuccessful for a short period of time, you're better off standing your ground because you at least have something to try and salvage and rebuild from. But if you only stand for what's currently popular, then you don't stand for anything.
Finally, tell us about his end. I'm old enough. I grew up in an environment where people died. Now they simply pass. You said he passed. There's a rugby league game on tonight and they pass in rugby league, but there you go. And in Aussie rules to some extent. So he comes back in 1927. He dies in 1947. Where's he buried? What do we know about his subsequent... What happens after his passing?
Well, he lives a pretty idyllic sort of retirement life. He becomes this farmer. So first, he sets up an orchard with one of his sons. They're growing citrus and stone fruit, and that becomes their sort of hobby farm. And then he... my understanding is then he buys larger areas of land in northern New South Wales and moves into, I think it's cattle or something like that. So he lives to 87. He's a very old man by the standards of the time, and quite a healthy man up until the end. He does suffer from bouts of sort of rheumatism, is what it's variously labelled, but there might be some sort of lingering effects from his time in the mines. But essentially he gets out of the mines just in time to not affect his health. Because he is so Protestant and Methodist, he's a teetotaler his whole life, so I'm sure that probably helped with his enduring health, even though it probably didn't help with him enjoying life. But my understanding is that he certainly didn't have a sort of rapid decline. He had quite the nice retirement, all things considered.
Probably helped with all those children.
It escapes me. I think it is in Sydney, but I'll have to double check.
Okay, well, I mean, it's a bit of a down way to end on it because we're all going home for a drink tonight, and Cook lived longer because he didn't drink. I think that's what we're taking from tonight. But he's from Melbourne, and you know.
I'm not from Melbourne. I'm a New South Wales.
You hang out down there.
He's a spy.
With all the other locker-uppers. many thanks for that. Look, it was a great talk, and I learned a lot. I'm sure we all did. It was entertaining, and you managed to speak for 35 minutes without a note, which is quite an achievement, I must say, and coherently, which is even more an achievement without a note. So look, tonight we're launching in the Sydney Zachary Gorman's book Joseph Cook, and we've got a few copies that MUP put out of the Young Menzies. Zachary and the Menzies Institute down in Melbourne's putting out some very important works. This one with a number of essays, including from two of our most formidable Sheilas, Judith Brett and Ann Henderson are in this. But for tonight, for Zachary, and their copies of Joseph Cook out there, I'm sure he'll sign them. Joseph, well done. And what?
You said I'm sure he'll sign them.
What? I don't know.
Sorry.
Can't we get interjections here? Okay. Well done, Zachary.
Thanks. Okay.